This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Now, it's 500 years since Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of his Wittenberg church, attacking the Catholic Church's corrupt practice of selling indulgences to absolve sin, setting in train the Protestant Reformation. But was this really about religion? Or was it a cynical power grab by some of the princes of Europe? Or was it an early manifestation of Brexit, a disillusionment of the periphery with the perceived corruption of the cosmopolitan centre? What is its relevance today? Now, to discuss these and related matters, we have assembled a scholarly and ecumenical panel. On my left here, we've Adrian Empey of the Church of Ireland Historical Society. And beside Adrian, beside me here, we have Alison Forrestal of NUI Galway. And then on my right, John McCafferty of UCD. And on the far right, Geza Thiessen of Trinity College, Dublin. Now, if you're not familiar with the HedgeGhoul format, don't relax too much because it is a school. You are expected to pay attention, to do a bit of work, get involved, ask questions, put your hand up. So, at any stage of the discussion, if you have something to say or something to contribute, just get my attention and we'll pass it on to the panel. And certainly there will be plenty of time later on for discussion from you, the audience. Now, John Caffrey, maybe just get started with you. I think we need to just get some idea of what was the political state of play in Europe. Because one thing that strikes me is Charles the Fifth, or Carlos the Fifth, whichever way you want to pronounce it, who is the Habsburg Emperor, by a fate, dynastic sort of a quirk, had managed basically to end up in control of all of Europe except France. Am I correct in that?
Well, yeah, large swathes of Europe anyway.
So yeah. It's... Just give us a rundown then. What was the state of play then? Because it's almost like this, the Reformation comes totally out of the blue, unexpected. We'll come back to that maybe in a minute. But give us a quick pen picture of Europe at that time.
Okay. Well, two perhaps different things are going on at the same time. First of all, the church in Europe, the Christian church in Europe, because there is only one church, is about 1,000 years old and has developed customs and traditions to go with that, and is so large and so comprehensive that apart from the Jewish populations and the few Muslims on continental Europe at this point, nobody thinks of being anything else other than a member of the church. So in one sense, Europe is deeply united in that, in what we now consider to be Western Europe and all the way over to the Orthodox and Islamic lands, there is one church. Then within that, two very different things are going on. On the one hand, there's a super state of the kind that you talk about, ruled by Charles V, emerging. But on the other hand, there are clear signs that some of the realms of Europe, like France and England, are going the way and becoming what we begin to see as modern nation states.
Now, just in terms of, just give us what exactly the Charles, in terms of territory, what did Charles V control? Okay, Spain, perhaps Austria, where else?
Most of southern Italy. The two Sicilies, the Spanish Netherlands, well, in fact, the whole area of the Low Countries.
Okay. Now, the thing is, of course, this is not unified in the sense that there's different jurisdictions, different political traditions in this, you know, what looks like an empire.
It's what's called a dynastic union. It's okay. All focused on him.
Right.
And an awful lot of this Reformation stuff is about men and their reproductive problems. Basically, frankly.
Can we get on to the, maybe bring you in on this, Adrian, and all of you, I mean, all jump in if you want to. Just in terms of the church, I mean, how wealthy, powerful, or corrupt was the church at this stage?
Wow. Well,
2 minutes.
Obviously, it's a very wealthy institution because over 1,000 years, people have given gifts of estates and so on. So you have some immensely wealthy monasteries. You would have immensely wealthy bishops too, who govern very large dioceses north of the Alps, unlike Italy, where they were small and urban-based. And over the centuries, they too had often been gifted by their rulers, kings and so on, and high nobility. So that, yes, the church sometimes estimated in areas of Europe to be possibly about a third of the landed wealth was in the hands of the church. I don't think it was that high in Ireland. I think that the church itself was, on the one hand, immensely sophisticated. I mean, you've only got to look at the papal registers, letters, and so on, to see the extraordinary range of the papal chancery. You know, parishes in the west of Ireland or parishes in Lithuania or somewhere. You know, and these all... So I think that's the sort of extraordinary range and sophistication of the church's organs of state. At the same time, in the middle of it, it's immensely complex because the papacy, you know, it goes up and down in the 15th century, it was pretty down. It had survived attempts to subject it to great council at Constance and so on in 1415. After being divided at the end of the 14th century, we had two and sometimes three popes. So the prestige had diminished. And in the end of the sort of 15th century, the Renaissance papacy with all its brilliance and, of course, also attracted a great deal of bad attention for the morality of Rome and so on, but brilliant also. So it's very complex. I think that I would take the view that the late medieval church, for all its problems that people had acknowledged for, a couple of centuries, there have been many demands for reform. Nevertheless, it was very lively, and all kinds of things were happening, spiritual movements and revivals, for instance, in Ireland, the tremendous revivals of the mendicant orders, and which I think in many ways responsible for salvaging the Catholic tradition in Ireland. I would say to take even this place here, we still have uniquely in Ireland the church wardens' accounts from 1481 for here. They show a medieval congregation that is where the laity exercise very considerable control. They're obviously very proud of their church. And they maintain the building, the fabric. They pay for chaplains to do this, that, and the other. So you do get the sense that the church is very far from being dead, or that all of it needed an overhaul. I would certainly not be happy with that description of the late medieval church.
Well, that's funny now, coming to you as a Church of Ireland man, you're saying then the Reformation wasn't necessary then, Adrian.
That's a big one. Well, there's two things here. First of all, as a historian, you to try to engage with the past. You enter into a conversation, and it's not really for us to make these judgments on what people do in the past. I would be very reluctant to put questions like that. At the same time, I suppose if you're asking me, was the Reformation inevitable? I don't think it was. I think that the circumstances that led to Luther's protest was incremental. He started out as a pastoral, local, regional protest, and for all kinds of ecclesiastical politics, he's dragged into something bigger. There have been other protests, in the 15th century, but they'd not come to anything more than regional.
Giesecke, bringing you in here, because you were talking about not being judgmental. I mean, Luther could be pretty judgmental in his time. Talk to a little bit about the man. Who was Martin Luther? Before you go on to... And then my next question is, what was it that provoked his ire?
I suppose, first thing you have to think about, he was a medieval man. So he lived... He is a man of his time. he wanted originally to become a lawyer, and that's what he studied for. But he had this incredible experience, and that seems to be true, historical, that one night he went into a thunderstorm, and he said, if I get out of that, he prayed to St. Anna, I will dedicate my life to God. So he's very deeply in that tradition. So then he becomes a monk, and he is a very, very scrupulous monk, over-scrupulous. So he's full of conscience, full of thought. And then gradually he comes to realize that the gospel really is about freedom. So what really got him going was the question about the freedom of the human being before God. Yeah? And he saw all around him, of course, that there were loads of abuses going on, and people in Germany were completely fed up with paying all this money to the Pope. So there was a great, great sense of
There is a Brexit parallel there, in my introduction, this idea that people are feeling ripped off by the centre to some extent.
Yeah, they felt very ripped off by the centre. I mean, but you see, the Brexit would mean we want to we want to break with the Catholic Church. Now, that's the last thing that Luther had in mind. Mm. He wanted simply reforms for the church. Mm. You know, and the first thing would have been that, get rid of the abuses. Mm. And if the Pope had gone with us, my sense is that, this bit would not have happened if they really had cleaned up about the abuses.
Can I just bring John, you in there on that one? So there's a perception then that Germany basically, is being ripped off by Rome. Is that true? Any more than anywhere else? I mean, as Adrian has explained, it's a very complex institution. It needs to be financed.
Mm-hmm. I think what happens in Germany is that Germany is not Germany, for a start. It's a patchwork of independent lordships and dominions and towns and bishoprics and so on. And what we see is, if you want to use your Brexit parallel, it would be rather like if a movement started in Essex to break with London, and it suddenly cascaded into spreading from county to county in England and then into Wales and Scotland, perhaps, and cascaded into a unified movement to do something else. So I think the extreme local nature of Germany facilitated this, and nobody saw it coming. And it is true that Luther didn't want to. He wanted to reform the church. No one could think of, I think it's very important to say this, no one could actually think in terms of the idea that there would be a permanent situation in which there were multiple churches, mutually exclusive. No one could get their heads around that, because that had never happened before.
Right.
Yeah, that wasn't the intention. I think you also have to bring in here the printing press, because that really made all the difference, that suddenly all these ideas could be spread like wildfire. And, when Luther went to Worms, he was kind of celebrated like a hero. So it captured the mind.
So, the printing press is a bit like social media today. I mean, this goes viral. I mean, the modern thing.
Trump tweeting.
Adrian, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, I would also say that, I agree what has been said, but that, that nobody could think outside the idea of a unified church. Now, that also went, we need to bear this in mind, because we are looking back at something that was someone else's future, which was never clear any more than our future is clear. But the point is that I think it would have gone for virtually all of the major Protestant traditions. They saw themselves as reforming the church from within, and they expected that one day their reform would embrace the entire church. They didn't think in terms of breaking with the church. That sense that was not really present in the 16th century. So that paradigm applied to all in a way.
But isn't that what made it in the long run? Just looking forward by a century to the religious wars. That's what made it so intractable. In other words, this wasn't a struggle to establish the existence of some dissenting religious tradition. This was a struggle for hegemony of the whole thing, going by what you're saying.
Well, I don't think that the struggles that are going on in, I think Gaza would be better, but I don't think that the struggles were any more than regional. as John said, they weren't. Nobody was planning to conquer the whole of Europe. That was not part of the bargain. But what local rulers were trying to achieve on both sides, what was control, greater control of the organs of the church. And that went go back all the way to Constantine in the 4th century. But within the Catholic Church itself, I mean, the monarchs of France and Spain and Portugal exercised huge control over the patronage and appointment of bishops and so on, and very little control from Rome. So that rulers saw the management of the church as part and parcel of the management of their territories. Mm. And we don't have to think they're necessarily cynical about this. They would have seen it as their duty from the time of Constantine on, really, to take care and to protect and defend the church. Every medieval monarch swore to uphold the liberties of the church and so on. And so that was the cura religionis was pretty much applied across Europe. So that I think we've got to put it in that context.
Alison, can I bring you in on that, right? Would you go along with that? I mean, because in my introduction, you know, I just to provoke discussion, I raised the point that is this just a political maneuver? Like once the Reformation gathers a head of steam, is it a political maneuver by certain princes in Europe, you know, for a power grab, you know, that they can... They already exercise some control, but they want to exercise total control over
it depends
local
on,
churches.
It depends on the ruler. And perception is as important as anything else when it comes to reality, when it comes to dealing with the realities of the situation. Because it's like, to go back to this point about people were fed up with the abuses. Yes, they were, but it's perceived financial irregularities as much as anything else. What has to be remembered is that in Germany and in France as well, perhaps even more so, an awful lot of the money that's collected that people are being told to be fed up about or becoming fed up about is not going to Rome at all. It's staying in Germany and it's staying in France, and it's going straight into the hands of royal families and into the hands of nobles and also into the hands of city councils, which had been really successful in German imperial cities in the generation up to 1517, really successful in actually beginning to tax the clergy, in appointing clergy themselves, and in ensuring that much of that what they would have regarded as financial privilege of the church that was draining, if you like, local communities, actually had been reduced very substantially. So in that sense, the 350, was it million, billion, that was on the buses for Brexit in Britain, it's a similar kind of situation, that people are perceiving that this money is going to Rome. Things like papal annats are, but much else isn't. So there is an element of cynicism involved, I think, with political rulers and political authorities in this kind of process.
Just to clarify there, Alison, what you're saying is that a lot of this money that is perceived to that in a popular perception is being, you know, collected
straight up,
sent to Rome. You're saying, in fact, it is spread out locally.
Yes.
Sent locally.
Yes.
Does that contradict some of what Geza was saying in terms of the perception in Germany?
I don't think it contradicts at all, really, in a sense, because some of this money is definitely going to Rome, and then some of it isn't as well. Yeah. It is staying in local areas, but it is not going. It is not being maintained in the hands of ordinary people. It is going into the hands of noble families and others who are effectively creaming off incomes from benefices. They're getting pensions from bishoprics, they're doing all kinds of things which benefit themselves and enable them really to strengthen their dynastic or their regional power in any given area.
Now, it seems to me that what tips the balance then is, and it's funny how history repeats itself, is a building project whose budget was out of control. We're talking here about the restoration of St. Peter's, right?
Oh, yes.
happens all the time, right? And this is when then John Tetzel comes up this great wheeze of selling indulgences.
Yeah.
Maybe, Geza, could you briefly give us a rundown on the theology of indulgences? Anyone else who wants to contribute in this one, right? Just explain then what was proposed here.
Well, it was basically trying to get one's relations, I suppose, out of figure fire.
Purgatory.
Yeah, out of purgatory. Exactly. And so you paid sums of money for that, and you would be assured then that they would get out and you yourself would go do a good deed. And it was basically telling, telling lies to the people and making them believe something that was absolutely not happening or which was totally sinful.
So they were to monetize what, you know, you do a good deed. That would,
you do a good deed. You're trying to buy yourself a place in heaven.
So instead you just pay a cash sum.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and that's why Luther comes up and it says it's about faith, it's about grace. Everything is given to us by God. Pure grace, pure faith, and nothing can buy us a place. You know, it all brings in also the question of, you know, how much does the human, is the human being involved in salvation? Yeah, for Luther it would have been very much a question of gift because he really just reread St. Paul, and that's where he found all his theology and Augustine. You see, those two.
Would it be correct to observe maybe that his legal cast of mind came into play here? And obviously, spotted like the rule, the rule's been Roman.
He didn't really
over.
Have a legal cast of mind.
No, he didn't have a legal cast of mind. I wouldn't think so at all. I think he just became a lawyer because his father wanted it. But he just had this incredible sense of vocation, you know, and he really did have, you know, he was a very, very scrupulous monk, prayed all the time. Just rereading St. Paul, that was really, I think, the clue to what made him rethink the whole teaching of salvation.
Right. Now, this is in... Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, just on indulgences.
Just on indulgences. Well, I absolutely agree with Geyser. That's what outraged Luther, because before this, he'd been arriving at a theological point whereby, the only faith is the means of faith alone is the means of gaining God's acceptance, so to speak, and not anything we can do, good works or whatever. Whereas in the late medieval theology, certainly good works was quite a part of it. Now, for instance, in ordinary wills that you'd find, some of them are here for Dublin Diocese in the 15th century. People lay out money for good works, you know, and works of mercy and all kinds of practical things. A lot of almshouses, which were very good things, providing for the poor and so on. It was a way of expressing. The idea was that you were expressing your contrition. The theology of the indulgence insisted upon prior contrition. It wasn't, but the perception of it was that it was a money transaction. But the theology was rather carefully nuanced, actually.
And the purchase of an indulgence was supposed to be accompanied by another act as well, such as a penitential act, like going on pilgrimage or giving alms. But I think that Geyser is absolutely right in the sense that, again, it's this perception, isn't it? And the church had done very little to counter quite a popular idea that if you bought an indulgence, then that meant that your sins were forgiven. When what indulgences were supposed to be about was part of these acts of contrition that people were doing. And they also were supposed to be a reneging of temporal punishment, not of purgatory. But the popular perception, which the church had done very little to counter in marketing indulgences, and there was a lot of marketing of indulgences, the popular perception was that essentially you bought one and maybe you went on pilgrimage as well or said some prayers or whatever, but essentially you would reduce your time or a loved one's time in purgatory.
Yeah. Now maybe I just want to come in there because, you know, the perception has often been that Luther was against good works. So Catholics are all about good works and Protestants are all about faith. Now, I think that's, it's really important that he actually said that, you know, works are absolutely important and they really belong to faith. But this, the spirit, how they evolve. You don't do so many good works in order to get into heaven. You do good works because that must be a natural follow-on from your faith. In other words, to say that you have faith, but you don't do any good to your neighbor, well, that's not a credible faith.
Okay.
So he said, you know, for him,
it's a manifestation of your faith.
Good works is a given.
Yeah, yeah.
They just must arise. They just do arise when we believe in a God who is love.
Yeah. Now, how long did it take for he nails up his did he actually nail it up, by the way? Curious, like.
He probably never did.
He had the hammer.
He probably never did, but he sent them out for discussion.
But that was in 1517. Now, how long did it take before the break, you know, the definite break occurred?
Excommunication is in... The document is in July 1520, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it reaches Germany by December 1520, because there's a very famous location, isn't there, in Wittenberg, where there's an oak tree, and the current oak tree is from 1831,
yeah.
but it was replacing a much older one, and that's supposed to be the site where Luther's supporters burned the Bull of Excommunication. But it wasn't until April of 1521 then that he became a persona non grata in the empire. So at that stage he was essentially, you know, under threat from both church and empire.
Okay, and in previous eras, he would have just been rounded up, burnt at the stake or whatever, right? So why that not happen? Why was Luther, he was obviously protected. For, you know, who is he protected by and why? Well,
Frederick the Wise. Frederick the Wise was his great protector. Without him, he would probably would have been killed.
Right.
Yeah. So he really helped him. I don't know whether you've seen the Luther film that came out a few years ago with Ralph Fiennes. And there is a meeting between the two. Well, that probably never happened. It seems that he never actually met him. But he liked his thought. Frederick the Wise simply liked Luther's thought and said, you know, he's one of my subjects. I will protect him. He founded a new university, of course, in Wittenberg. I mean, Wittenberg was a tiny little place in the back of beyond in Saxony. So Frederick the Wise also had 19,000 relics. He was a very wealthy man. But he just supported Luther and his cause.
I always think it's interesting as well that... I'm talking too much now.
No,
but I always think it's interesting that Wittenberg University was founded in 1502, and it's the first university in Germany to be founded without papal approval.
Right.
And that in itself, it just... I don't know what it means, if it means anything, or what it tells us about Wittenberg itself, but it's very interesting to me that is the first university in Germany, and that is where this happens. You know, 15 years later.
It tells you maybe something about the power of the local princes at the time.
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah.
John, just go to you on this one then, about the people, the princes who backed Luther then, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of risk were they taking? Like, you know, was there the wherewithal by the emperor or whatever to take them out or whatever?
Well, there's quite a lot of... religious conflict rumbles on through Europe for the next 150 years or so. So in one sense there is, but then in another sense, in a very, very decentralized region with a lot of volatile power play, these guys are calculating the angles. And there is enough room for them to establish what loosely becomes a movement. But there's a lot of time spent by... For instance, Henry VIII hated Luther. And the reason he hates Luther is Luther keeps trying to advise him, keeps trying to tell him what to do. So you can see there are points at which Luther and his followers overstep themselves by trying to tell rulers what to do, because previously with someone like Frederick the Wise, they've had a good experience. So, but things, the dynastic principle is very, very important here, and I wasn't being entirely facetious when I mentioned about reproduction, because succession and the production of heirs was so important. Things could change very, very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, you know, a child ruler could die, and a whole area could change its religious complexion just like that. So there's a huge... instability, which is reflective of the general instability in early modern Europe, where lifespans are short and people die suddenly and unexpectedly.
You use the word there, a movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's just interrogate that for a minute, because in the next breath you said that this dynastic volatility could change the religious complexion, but that would seem to imply there's not a movement at all, that it's just basically a question of the cuius regio, who's the guy at the top.
There's both things happened.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is, to what extent was this a popular movement?
There's quite a lot of in parts of Germany. There are places where, and I can't remember these, where one Sunday, there's full-on mass, vestments, everything. Yeah. And the next Sunday, the people walk in, the citizens, the students in particular. Students are really important in this movement. Mm. Everything is in German. There are no vestments. There is a table. There isn't an altar. There are several instances where
this happens. There are always kind of steps that take place over the course of about a year where you'll get some preachers who are starting to preach some of the new ideas, and they may be coming in from outside or they may be some of the locals. And then you'll get a bit of unrest with public disputes. You'll get perhaps a bit of iconoclasm and breaking down. And then it's only then, really, that you tend to get city councils sitting up and thinking, we're going to have to control this. And they start to organise disputations between traditional clergy and these new preachers, and they announce that the city council is going to be the arbitrator and judge of the outcome of the debate. They also tend to make rules, and this is the dead giveaway, they say that we will judge whether the preaching is according to scripture, and that is the giveaway phrase, because then you know that they effectively, either there is a cohort in the city council who are supporting it, or they're very, very afraid that if they don't move towards it, that there will be a kind of popular uprising, often coming from guild members who are really highly organised in places like Augsburg.
Mm. And there are spectacular moments where, for instance, there's this famous incident in Denmark where one of the country's leading preachers, who is, I think, a Dominican, gets up into the pulpit and takes off his habit and says, I've had enough of this. This happens as well. There are individual spectacular moments of conversion. And almost all the early Reformation leaders are themselves people, by and large, they're members of the mendicant clergy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And these are the best educated, most religiously committed people in Europe. And the irony is that an awful lot of what they think, whether they end up Catholic or they end up Lutheran or even Calvinist, is basically the same. They just want to live the gospel better. But it takes radically different forms. So there are a whole bunch of people, their mates who've all been to university together, who find themselves with all the love and hatred that people who have previously been close to each other are capable of displaying. So it's intensely personal.
I think one of the very problematic areas, of the early Reformation is the degree to which it was popular. That it was, subscribed to by people on the ground. And that's very difficult to determine, in fact. And, for instance, there's been quite a bit of revision going on in about the English Reformation.
Yeah, I'm just going to be fair.
The old narrative was that it was kind of, there was anti-clericism and all of that kind of thing, and it was almost a kind of pre-gone conclusion. But I think a lot of more recent scholarship suggests that there was actually a tremendous amount of resistance parochially and on the ground, and so it took decades and decades, perhaps in England. Now it's a very stop-start kind of Reformation for dynastic reasons that John has just talked about. But eventually it becomes embedded. Maybe sometime in the later 16th century when people begin to become familiar with the Bible in the vernacular, the sort of Puritan movement, which is based to a considerable degree on their own reading. But that's later, that's decades on from Henry. So there's huge areas of unknowing, and we have to be careful in sort of crossing that territory with ready-made formula.
Now, we need to get on to the English Reformation, but before that, Dougie, so I want to come back to you, because you mentioned in terms of Luther's motivation, his focus on the idea of freedom, right?
Yeah.
Now, of course, freedom is one of these things that's open to interpretation, and of course, in 1525, the peasants of Germany had their own interpretation and rose up in revolt. And the first question is, were they inspired by Luther to any extent, or was this completely a separate issue? I know it's a complex thing, but I mean, were they fired up by the rhetoric of Luther?
Well, I think the person most involved were the peasants, it was Thomas Münzer. And he went further than Luther, and in the end, he and Luther fell out because he felt that Luther was far too nice to the kind of, to the ones in power, to the leaders.
They were the ones who were protecting him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Munzer, he really supported the peasants, and it was a terrible war. And Luther, in the end, I think, was really, really shocked, actually, what did happen with him. He was, you know, quite taken aback, but he also really gave out about them and said, you know, he had the strong sense that, you know, die Obrigkeit, the leaders, you know, they are in charge, and that's the worldly reign, and so you have to kind of obey them. And still in the 20th century, we've seen what that can lead to. You know, that's that sense of, yeah, you know, following your leaders, being their subjects.
But what, was there once, I mean, Luther basically condemned it, right? In pretty vitriolic language.
He did, yes. Yeah.
Was there, did that provoke a huge sense of disillusionment then with the Reformation project? Or did those people matter? In other words, the peasants at the bottom.
It didn't matter as much as the leaders. So in the end, I think it didn't hold up the Reformation. The Reformation
went ahead.
Let's
comment on that.
But it is one of those really really sad chapters, I think, in the whole Reformation, in the Reformation history. Really, that fallout between Luther and Münzer. There's actually last night and tonight there's a program on BBC 4. I don't know whether you saw it, but this time they really brought in Münzer. There's this really interesting, and it's a German film being made about Luther, whereas before, Münzer didn't play any role at all in any films being made about him. So he's getting a greater look in what he actually did and the good things that he did.
What happened to Münzer, by the way, in the end?
He's executed.
Mm. Right, okay.
Yes.
So he gets his comeuppance.
Well, it's not comeuppance so much, I suppose. Munzer he's very representative of a type of leader in the peasant revolt, but he's different to some of the others in the sense that he is more of a visionary than some of the others.
Mm. Too much of a visionary, possibly? Right?
Well, he's the arch-devil at Mühlhausen, according to Martin Luther in the famous text that Luther wrote against him. But to go back to the question about what's the result of this, well, I think there are two results of the peasant revolt. One, it sends the rulers flying over to the mainstream reform as it's emerging, because they are frightened to death by the peasant revolt. They are very taken with Luther's ideas about the relationship between church and state. The other result really is that there is a connection between the peasant revolt and the emergence of more radical groups amongst the Anabaptists. Mm. I think in some ways it's the trauma and the disappointment of failure that really causes some of the leaders and some of the more middling peasant rebels that survive to take to Anabaptist groups, which are more radical in their theology, but are also more, Geza would know more about these kind of Anabaptist groups, I think, but in the theology, but they are more, affected by ideas of being a church of the elect, of being distinct and separate from society as well. And I think that there is a connection in that sense. It's not that the peasant revolt causes the Anabaptist groups to emerge, because radical groups probably would have emerged anyway in the splintering of the reform movement. But there certainly is something, I think, to do here with the failure and the trauma of this great experiment where they were using ideas of spiritual equality to translate into ideas of greater representation of the common man and of more equitable distribution of resources. It's not that they were looking for a kind of communist society, but they wanted a more equitable distribution of resources and a greater voice for negotiation on the part of local communities. They were very communally organized, and a lot of them came from areas, a lot of where, in Swabia, for example, a lot of the peasant rebels there came from, the leaders tended to come from the upper ranks, and these were people who had been involved in parish councils and other kinds of communal assemblies. So they were quite taken with the idea of being able to represent themselves and to negotiate terms of land, terms of rent, terms of labour dues and things like that in an area, particularly in Swabia, where serfdom had been reinforced in the previous generation.
Okay, but this brings up one of the problems then with the Protestant Reformation is once it starts, once you have protesters and dissenters, where does it stop? I mean, in a sense, it bears out the Catholic position. I mean, so you're going to get this stage after stage, because then, of course, you have Calvin comes along, you have the Calvinist tradition. Mm-hmm. So where do they fit into this picture, Geza?
Well, I suppose, you know, when you start a movement, you do not know where it ends up. Mm. You see, and Luther was really faced by that. I think at the end of his life, he was already fed up with sort of, you know, all these different movements that were springing about. He was not happy about that, you know, and he famously really fell out with Calvin and especially with Zwingli over the Eucharist. He wanted just certain changes. The next generation took it further, and then you have the kind of the spreading of all sorts of movements then also, I suppose, in the new world, you know. And that's why you have nowadays so many different churches, you know, including whatever the Pentecostals and all of that, but that's quite removed from the more magisterial reformers, you know, like Luther, and I suppose originally Calvin as well.
I think perhaps a pivotal moment is the colloquy of Marburg in 1529, when there's an attempt by the various Protestant groups in South Germany and Luther in North Germany to try to subscribe to a sort of common confession, because they're faced with always the problems of maybe Charles V is about to move in on them. So they can agree, I think, they had 15 points. I think they could agree on 14, but they got stuck on the question of the real presence in the Eucharist. And the interesting thing there is it hinged on what you understood about Scripture. So the thing, the formula, sola scriptura, by Scripture alone, breaks down when it's put to the test. And when it's put to the acid test, because people bring to it their own theologies and read different things into whatever the New Testament authors may have intended when they wrote it. So immediately you get a mess.
Now, I want to move on, just move things a bit closer to home here, right? And look at the English Reformation, John, because you were saying that Henry VIII detested Luther, and of course he wrote against him, and then he was given the title Defender of the Faith.
Yes.
Still one of the official titles of British monarchs, of course, to this day. Just talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, so you often hear it said, for example, that Henry VIII went to his deathbed convinced, you know, he was still a good Catholic, right? Is that true? I mean, was all this a big accident?
Well, Henry is vacillating during his life. He changes. Henry is an equal opportunities monarch. In July 1540, in the morning, Henry causes three Lutherans, including a close friend of Martin Luther's, to be burnt at the stake. And in the afternoon, three Catholics loyal to the Pope are hanged, drawn, and quartered at Smithfield. So that gives you a little vignette of, you know, if you look at an early modern monarch, it's how they execute their subjects is always interesting.
Which is better, Henry, by the way, hung, drawn, or quartered, or burnt? Sorry.
Try that one, John, here.
Apparently, burnt at the stake because you're asphyxiated by the smoke first.
Okay,
it,
right.
It knocks you out.
Must remember that one.
Yeah, just in case. Hang, drawn, and quartered is particularly nasty.
Right, yeah.
So Henry is moving around. There is a Lutheran movement in England. Thomas Cromwell, his chief advisor, is undoubtedly influenced by it. There are people who are trying to push a Lutheran agenda. Henry vacillates back and forward, and part of it is to do with his marital problems as he moves from spouse to spouse, each of whom is backed by different factions within the court. Initially, Henry's Reformation is essentially Catholicism without the Pope.
Right.
It's an independent national church. And then, because of the influence of the advisors, we get, for instance, it's 1549 before there's a prayer book in English. It's a decade and a half after Henry breaks with Rome. Henry likes Mass, and he likes Latin Mass, and he likes polyphony, and he likes all of the things that go with it. So Henry produces, in some ways, a sulk. Where he has broken Rome, but he won't be told what to do by any of the leading Protestant reformers.
Would it be, what about the argument, Adrian, that the real English Reformation that takes place under Edward, his successor?
Well, there's a lot, I suppose, to be said for that, because it signifies a major theological shift away from the Henrician fudge, I suppose you might say, where nobody quite knew what direction they were moving in. But under Edward, there's a decisive shift under the Somerset and so on, these people who are other effectively governing, because Edward's only a little fellow in short trousers. And they are decisively making the choice for a prayer book in English, and then a revised prayer book, which is much more radical than the original, rather more conservative one. So you see the direction in which it is moving, very much under the influence of, increasingly of Geneva. Mm-hmm. So away from Luther's, mm-hmm. In some respects, more generous theology, towards a much more legalistic theology stemming from Geneva.
Now, and of course, it's not until the reign of Elizabeth, then, you have the formal establishment of an established Protestant church, Church of England. What was that, 1560?
1559.
Okay. Yeah. And is the Church of Ireland established at the same time?
Well, it goes along roughly the same trajectory. The Reformation Parliament in England is 1534, and it's 1356 in Ireland, isn't it?
1536.
So there's slight, but basically it's all reenacted again in Ireland, fundamentally, yes.
Well, now this comes to the perennial question then, you know, why did the Reformation fail in Ireland? Of course, that's a loaded question in itself, but I mean, in general, it didn't. I mean, it didn't win the minds and hearts of the vast bulk of the people. I mean, was it ever likely to? I mean, I was looking at some figures there. I mean, the number of Protestant clergymen in the country, I mean, you're talking about scores of people. You could count them on a very small number of hands, you know. I mean, it seemed like it was an impossible task.
I mean, Alison, I'll have a go at it, but...
I think it is very, very difficult because they do run it. I mean, I'm no longer work on Irish history, but I suppose in a sense I know, you know, a fair bit about it. There are major problems emerging in terms of personnel. First of all, with older bishops who are supposed to be spearheading whatever kind of reform is supposed to be coming into Ireland, who are essentially sort of sitting back and not really doing very much about it. Those that are brought in then, I mean, Bale in Ossory is one example, isn't it, who's brought in the 1550s and finds it extremely difficult. They're often very disillusioned, I think, by a kind of recalcitrance in some areas, indifference in other areas. There are problems of infrastructure and of having enough committed clergy themselves. There's no printing press in Ireland till 1551, and that is brought in to print off copies of the Book of Common Prayer. So there are even just resource and mechanical issues as well that the Crown doesn't really seem to be taking terribly seriously in Ireland. I don't know if John and Adrian and Gizem would agree, but it's almost like Ireland is sort of an afterthought when it comes to proselytization or evangelization.
Well, I think the problem in Ireland is that there's too much going on at the same time, because when the Crown tries to you can basically change the religion of any large group of people over several generations, as Adrian says, more or less, of most people. But the Crown in Ireland tries to do three things simultaneously. It tries to Protestantize the population. It fights a war of conquest, and then it changes the nature of the population by settling about 100,000 new people on the landscape, all of whom are either English or Scottish, and tries to create a new British identity out of that. And when you try and do those three things at once, and then when between 85 and 90% of the population speak Irish and not English, and you don't make provision to do what the Reformation is about, which is putting the scripture and all the rest in the language of the people, at the same time, or you leave it so late that it's too late, you're in real trouble. You're in real trouble. It's like trying to, it would be like trying to get every child in the country now to go back to reading without providing any print books and not closing down the internet. You just can't do it. It's just not going to work. You need to go in fast and quick if you wanted to do it.
But what about the second point in your list there, though, the fact that it's a conquest. In other words, if this is coming at the point of a sword, it's not going to be popular, is it?
There's two things happen, a large number of people, the Irish-speaking people, mostly Gaelic Irish, see this as a war of conquest and expropriation. The English-speaking population.
But it is, John.
It is.
It's not just perception. It actually is.
Yes, of course it is. But the English-speaking population who have been here where we are for 400 or 500 years previously, the descendants of the Normans also get displaced by the new settlers. And they also remain loyal to Catholicism. So the group of people that Henry could have relied on, and initially looks like he definitely would have relied on, also go into opposition. So those things happen at the same time. Yes, and then there is a perception. People begin to make very, very similar. There's a Dublin merchant in the reign of Elizabeth, and he says this: the coinage has just been devalued, okay? And he's not happy about this because he's lost his shirt on it. And he's interrogated, and someone says to him, well, what about loyalty to the monarch and all the rest? He says, I can't even trust the queen with my money. How am I going to trust her with my soul? So effectively what he's saying is the Protestant Reformation, as far as he's concerned, is a scam. And there is a huge feeling among many people, and Catholic preachers are in there quick to exploit that, say, this whole thing is an alien imposition. The Annals of the Four Masters say about the English Reformation, they say it is a Saxon Reformation, in the term of, you know, in the sense that Saxon means English.
But it is, though.
Yes.
Isn't it?
From the pew, that's how it looks, and that's how it is played. And then also there is very little effective preaching in Irish, because some of the most committed preachers of all, the irony of the Irish Reformation, Counter-Reformation, is the people who do best out of the Irish language are actually the Catholic Church, the church whose official services are in Latin, because they get into the ground quickly, and they're preaching and teaching true Irish, and that's what 90% of the population understand. And the other lads are turning up and going, saying, oh, by the way, we're going to take your land, and while we're at it, would you mind terribly coming to these services in a language you don't understand?
Right.
Is that too flippant, Adrian?
No, you can't really. I think that one point I would make, I mean, it is rather like the Tory party doing Brexit, a complete mess, and of conflicting policies, because you get in the Henry's a sort of genuine attempt to try to incorporate the Gaelic nobility with this surrender and regrant thing. In other words, draw them into civil society, give them lovely titles and things like that, and eventually they'll be, you know, like good Englishmen. That kind of idea. That goes, of course, awry. And you get the wars of conquest, and of course it becomes a threat. And ironically, the people who are most loyal, the old English, they get it in the neck as well. So it's a complete mess. But I think at the same time, it's important to say that Brendan Bradshaw was the historian who, in a way, broke the logjam on the historiography of the Reformation in Ireland, which up to a certain point, up to maybe the, I don't know what, 1960 or something, had been largely written for confessional reasons, everyone having their own take on it and defending one side or the other. Whereas Bradshaw did try to deal with the evidence and tried to show that there was a point early on in the Reformation when Ireland is not so different. There's nothing unique about Ireland. It's not so different from the rest of Europe. We in fact, is more like it, because we had considerable towns and cities, unlike Wales, where actually the Reformation did take. So it's not simple. And he tried to point out that there was, within the Pale in particular, the old English gentry, some sympathy for a sort of Erasmus-type reform within the church. So that it's not of itself that it was impossible in Ireland. It was just that it was messed up by a Tory regime.
By the way, of course, Brendan Bradshaw, another Augustinian.
Marist.
Marist.
Oh, he's Marist, isn't he? Sorry, Marist.
Yes.
It's Marist,
I'm thinking of somebody else, sorry. Okay. Listen, anyone in the audience want to come in there at this stage? Because I'm just looking at the time here. If anyone has a question or make a point. Yeah. Do we have the radio mic? Yeah, if you use the radio mic, because this is being recorded, and it'll be put up a podcast on our website.
It's from what I hear, most Catholics think that Martin Luther and John Wesley were largely correct in the attitude that they took in their context of its day. On a theological point, I heard from Luther, did he believe in the equality of God and Christ, that Christ was God, as do the Church of Ireland, the Anglican people? The point I want to come to is that I suppose, as you mentioned, the Anabaptist reform movements, the Peasants' Revolt, can we assume that the Reformation in part helped create left-wing radical things like the Diggers and the Levellers? I know it didn't to any great extent, but I feel that it possibly did up to the point, especially if Martin Luther was partly sympathetic to the Peasants' Revolt, but not entirely.
Who wants to take that one? That's an interesting one. I mean, Luther as a sort of an early manifestation of, left-wing ideas, Giza?
Left-wing ideas. I mean, I suppose the idea of the freedom of the Christian, that would have been absolutely central to him. Left-wing ideas would have been more, I mean, if you want to put it, left-wing ideas more associated with Thomas Münzer, maybe, you know, because he was so strongly for the peasants. You also asked the question whether Luther believed that whether that Christ was God.
Well, in some instances, so as you move further left, some Protestants believe that Christ was only the Son of God, others that he was God.
Well, we believe in the Trinity.
Sorry?
You know, Christians believe in the Trinity.
Right.
So he is one of the three persons of the Trinity. So that's just, in accordance with the creed.
I think that, that the mainline Protestants like Calvin and Luther wish to emphasize their orthodoxy, and they would certainly took any attack on the Trinity very seriously, in fact, so seriously that Calvin fried poor Servetus, was it in 1553, for his anti-Trinitarian views, just as an example to show how orthodox we are in Geneva.
Mm. Yeah. Just picking up from that point, I'll go to you next. Picking up from that point, let's swing the argument the other way, right, which is the old Max Weber argument. Luther as a harbinger of capitalism. I mean, how does that idea stack up still?
Mm. Well, I think he thought that wasn't Luther so much. If he was to say anything, it was Calvin.
Calvin.
But it's kind of misread a lot of the time as well, I think, what Weber was trying to say. There might be... I don't buy it at all, personally, myself, because I think that there are other factors that are much more important. There is a burgeoning capitalism in areas already where he might identify as being the Protestant ethic areas. There are also other things to consider, such as emigration. A lot of that emigration into those areas is producing the kind of fluidity in business and in commerce that would mean that you would get those kinds of commercial practices and that kind of spirit of commerce. But there might be an argument, perhaps, I suppose, for saying that you can see some evidence of it, I suppose, in terms of the way in which there is maybe a relaxing of things like restrictions on usury and things like that. I suppose some of the John would know about the Protestant divines in England in the 17th century and their commentary on things like loans and banking, and there is a sort of they are trying to negotiate a way forward to encourage capitalism without going against the theology of their churches. But I don't see, personally, I don't see much more than that too.
Yeah. Well, they're advocating deregulation, is that what you're saying?
We see where that kind of trouble got us.
Did you want to pick up what the reference to you there, John?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, in some ways, Protestant divines had much more difficulty because of the emphasis on scripture. In fact, there'd been a long-standing tradition within the pre-Reformation Europe where you had what is effectively an early form of credit union, which got you around these problems.
Yeah.
And some of the most important and failing now Italian banks are named after these, but that's another story.
Yeah, and I think they were also very good at sort of, you know, setting up local charities, you know, the local charity box that existed. There was an early idea of basically what later become kind of the social welfare state. So that's also the I suppose the seeds of that is already laid in, you know, with the reformers, even with Luther, that chest that referred to the chest for the local people. So, yeah.
Why was it so inconceivable that there could be a split in the church or rival churches when they had before them, before the Reformation, the Lollards in England, the Hussites in Bohemia, the Waldensians in the Alps, all groups which were sort of saying some of the things that Protestants later said. So why was the Reformation different?
Yeah. The printing press, maybe? Yes, you mentioned that. You know, they didn't have access to the printing press, so the ideas,
the genie
stayed in the bottle, to some extent, stayed in the local region.
They tended to be very regional. Yeah.
I think, though, as I understood the question, it is why could they not... Why was everybody, so to speak, caught up in the same sort of paradigm of a single church for Christendom? You know, I think that's what you're saying. I think it's just that... you know, people grow up within that paradigm. It's very hard to see beyond it. And I think that there's a long history of, the conciliarism and so on, but it would always be within the context of a universal church. There was no non-universal church, so to speak, theologically available.
Yes, and I think like Luther, a lot of these movements saw themselves as reforming, you know, that they would eventually reform the church. Right. And many of them, indeed, so if you look at some of the groups in say, Italy in the 13th, 14th century, who officially became heretics, a whole group, and one of the most important groups of all, the Franciscans, didn't become heretics and stayed within inside the structure. So people were used to this idea that there would be occasional ferments, but the belief was that they would always settle down and things would resume as a universal church, but that might change the church somewhere along. So people had this idea of sort of, I don't know, a cycle. And when the Reformation came, a lot of commentators thought that this was going to be yet another episode in this long.
And their understanding of Reformatio and of the term revolution, they're both different to what we think about now as well. They didn't understand revolution in the same way that we would. Revolution simply meant revolving. So this was an endlessly revolving process whereby change would come about within the church itself, the church of people and church of institution. I think it took them quite a few years to realise that, well, actually, this isn't going to happen. And you get a lot of calls from everybody, basically, amongst the reformers in the first few years, calling for a church council to resolve the issues and to work from within it. And it's only gradually that those calls begin to die out, and the realization comes that actually that's not going to be the answer here.
I have two questions. One is about the connection between land ownership reform in Europe and the Reformation. Is there any connection? And my second is, if Munzer and Luther were here today, what would you ask them?
Around the dinner table.
So, the land owning question maybe first.
I'm not entirely sure that I see the direction of that question, in the sense that the Reformation as such did not produce any concept of legal, fundamental change in legal relationships. It's a very conservative business. I don't think that lordship or legal ownership really doesn't fit into that paradigm. I don't think the people thought anything beyond the social conventions and the place of the aristocracy and so on. They lived within that paradigm. I don't think they drew any conclusions that this should be fundamentally changed, except perhaps within the Munzer type, the extreme radical wings. Was there another question?
Yes. What question would we ask? Is that?
Yes. Munzer and Luther.
I think.
Where did you buy your nails?
Well, I think if you were kind of, tactic wise, I would say, well, would you like to go for a pint? He would immediately say, yes, I'd like to try the local Guinness. And I would give him a few, pints of Guinness. And then I would ask him the difficult questions. Why did you use such polemics? Why did you make it just so difficult for yourself in many ways? Why were you so undiplomatic at times?
And why did you speak so positively about the Jews and then
you spoke
so badly about them in the end?
Yeah.
You know, but I would also tell him he did some pretty good things, so I would tell him that too.
Just on that, like, I mean, there is his anti-Jewish pronouncements. I mean, when you see it, because I was in Berlin recently at the Jewish Museum, you know, and of course that's projecting things backwards to some extent. However, you know, having said all that, right, some pretty blood-curdling things.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the 20th century, the Nazis used exactly that. Mm. And on Luther's birthday, 1938, on the 10th of November, they went out and they had the Kristallnacht. You know, and they burned all the synagogues and they smashed the windows and all of that. So it's one of those things. Many things that Luther said, he said out of a moment. So you don't have a kind of a developed systematic theology like, for example, with Calvin. He writes a lot in the moment. So first, he writes very positively about the Jews. He says they should be included, they should be treated well. You know, we should teach them and all of that. And he really hoped to convert them. So he really, you know, they should be absolutely integral part of society and all of that. And he was really, really says some really good things. But then 20 years later, he writes so negatively about them because they wouldn't convert. And he just says they are so stubborn and they are terrible and they should, you know, you should take all their religious books away from them and they should be doing just manual work and you burn the synagogues and really awful things. You know, so I think it was this frustration that
how exceptional was that? Yeah, Adrian, the standards of the time.
Well, you did get throughout medieval Europe the most appalling anti-Jewish pogroms, quite dreadful.
Yeah.
And they were expelled from England in the later 14th century, I think, and so on. So that there was a pretty hostile, so to speak, theological atmosphere with regard to the Jews, mainly based on this idea that they were stubborn and also to when you went down that road, they killed Christ and the attempt to blame that on them. But the only thing one would say about that is that it's not really a precursor of the Nazi thing, because the Nazi thing was based on an entirely different philosophy of race, which, of course, was not present in the 16th century. So you don't get the race and the theological hatred, the odium theologicum, together, because the race thing didn't exist in Luther's time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very important difference, that for Luther it would have simply been inconceivable that people could not believe in Christ.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the real difference. But I think it should also be said that the Nazis used Nietzsche, they used Luther for their own aims. But of course, distorted them.
Now, anyone else want to come in here? I'm just looking at the time here. Just use the mic there.
I just wanted to know how women fared in the Reformation and whether they were treated by the Reformers any better than they were by the other Christians, the Catholic Christians.
That was the next question on my list here, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some funny things to say about women as well.
Yeah. It's one of those things. Luther was quite traditional in his view of women. You know, he didn't kind of say they should be ordained or something. That comes centuries later when the men went to war in the 20th century, then women were, as usual, good enough so they could do the job then. That only comes about in the 20th century in Germany. But Luther writes about women kind of twice, really, and earlier on he is quite strong about, you know, he writes a lot about Eve. And he says that Eve was subject to her husband before the fall, so women should also be subject to their men. But he does say that basically they are created the same. They should share in everything, they should bring up the children together and all of that. At some stage he even says, because of this idea of the priesthood of all believers, you know, that the fathers and mothers are bishops and apostles and priests to their children. But he says also that basically women are still subject to their husbands, and it's the husbands who are also in an ecclesial manner, because the husbands are those who are kind of preaching Christ. Now, when he writes about women the second time, he writes about women in a more kind of equal way. He speaks about Mary, about Eve being a very strong, kind of a heroic woman. And at that time, he is married and has already 6 children. And his wife, Katharina von Bora, was a really strong woman, and I think she sorted him out quite often. and he, as she says that as well, that sometimes, you know, women have to tell their husbands, you know, kind of basically what to do. So there is a mixing. He is traditional, and so the progressives and the conservatives will find, I suppose, ideas in Luther for or against, say, for example, the ordination of women. And to this day, you have Lutheran churches which don't ordain women and which do. Most of them do.
I think the way I look at it for the 16th century and into the 17th century is that all of the churches have big problems with dealing with women in the 16th and 17th century. Luther, to me, I always read Luther as being quite liking women that he knows and that he meets, and he loves his wife. He's a very good husband in lots of ways. But when he talks about women in the collective or in more abstract ways, that's when that negativity comes in. Women, you know, they're a bit of learning is bad for a woman. Women shouldn't be allowed to govern, that kind of thing, which is very conventional stuff in the 16th century. And if we look at the Protestant Reformed churches in general, I think what you see a lot of women are attracted to the Reform movement in its early years because it is in a series of growth. There's, in that growth phase, there are kind of opportunities to push the boundaries when they might be able to preach, they might take on public roles. And when you see more of the consolidation within the Protestant churches, they are effectively reined back into a domestic role, basically. So in some ways, the Protestant churches can be more restrictive for women in the early modern period than the Catholic Church was, because the Catholic Church had its own problems, as the Protestant churches did, with this sort of question about Eve and about the realities of women and reproduction and all of these kinds of things. But I suppose the Catholic Church, when it comes through with its big reform movement, it has that domestic role for women, which it's in many ways very similar to the kind of domestic role that the Protestant churches have for women, but it also has these very restrictive but at the same time empowering kinds of roles in terms of the emergence of new religious orders for women. And increasingly, as the 17th century moves on with the Catholic Reform movement, you're finding that you have the emergence of these religious orders which are protective for women, allowing them to take on public roles like nursing, teaching, and education. And we have to remember that in both the 16th and the 17th century, a public role for any woman was almost impossible. There was a circle of exclusions, really, that meant that women could not take part publicly in civil, ecclesiastical, or any other kind of public role within society. So it is a mixed bag, and it's a mixed bag for all of the churches, really. It's a very transitional period.
Adrian,
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. One thing I think might be said in favor of, well, we're not talking about in favor of anyone, but for Luther, is that while he's very traditional, he does talk up marriage, the sacrament of marriage. And he does, as distinct as being good in itself, not just a second-class option, to celibacy. And he sees part of the married state as being part of the divine order and all the rest of it, but he also sees it to some extent as about companionship. So that there's not just avoiding sin or something like that.
So it takes him a while to get there. He doesn't want to get married at first, and in fact he says initially the only reason he gets married is because everyone else in the movement
the other ex-clerics.
But then he takes to it rather well.
He does.
Once he gets there.
Exactly.
So
he learns the rules.
Yeah, he's got that.
Can I ask you a question there? Why did that thing of married clergy become such an issue for the Reformation? As you said, they're all doing it, right?
It's the first thing. A cleric who throws off his Dominican habit or whatever it is, the first thing he will do after that is go to get married. And there are lots of reasons, I suppose. Some of them maybe because they just always had wanted to. But it's also a highly symbolic act as well as a practical act. It indicates a throwing away of the old clerical rules and the church's rules about that. Mm. It indicates a rejection of the sacrament of ordination, which they are rejecting in and of itself. And it indicates the taking on of a new type of life, a new type of Christian life as a married man who is also an evangelizing kind of figure. Mm. So it's a really potent kind of act that they do.
It creates problems down the road, though, like organizational problems. Yeah. Because if you've married clergy, they have children, and then what do you do? That, yes. And you see the emergence of what one could describe as clerical dynasties, where the father is a bishop, the son is a bishop, the grandson is the bishop. So it plays out in most unexpected ways. And I think the other thing as well is some people have been living lives of hypocrisy. There were quite a number of clergy across medieval Europe who were having a fine old time, but the women that they were with had no status and were reviled.
Yeah.
So some of them kind of, said, great, this is an opportunity to, as it were, come out of the clerical closet and get married.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's more honest.
Yeah.
Now, anyone else like come in? Yeah, the mic there, if you could.
There have always been Catholic priests, and certainly in Ireland, who have been either married or procreating, because we have names like MacAnaspy, the son of the bishop, MacIntaggart, son of the priest. So I'm sure it wasn't unique to Ireland.
No, certainly not. It was in the 15th and early 16th century, it would have been relatively common for a priest to have a housekeeper, perhaps, or a niece who would stay at the house. And these were often kind of common law wives, really. It certainly wasn't uncommon at all. And sometimes they were reviled, particularly if the bishop arrived, and which didn't happen that often, and would sort of, bring them out to make an example of them. But I think in some communities it was quite accepted as well, wasn't it, that they would be living there with their families. Yeah. And of course, clerical dynasties in the 15th and 16th century could also be, an uncle parish priest passing to his nephew. Mm-hmm. But it was also the case that it was not uncommon for a priest father to pass the care of the parish onto the son. And because there were no seminaries, they were simply trained in liturgy and a bit of rubric and maybe a bit of preaching, at his side for as they grew up, and then went for ordination at that point. So there wasn't really a formal system of education and training for clergy at all. Up to the Reformation.
In fact, the papal archives, the records for Ireland, are stuffed with dispensations for the kind of people you mentioned, sons of priests and bishops, because technically all those children were illegitimate. You couldn't be ordained if you were illegitimate. Mm-hmm. So the Roman archives are full of people from all over Ireland, Wales, Scotland, Spain, all sorts of places, getting these dispensations. Mm-hmm. So in a curious way, all that costs money. And the Curia wasn't entirely unhappy with some aspects of it.
I think that in some respects it wasn't generally a matter of, what should I say, shock or horror for people accepted this apparently a lot in the Middle Ages. not necessarily universally, but I think also too in Ireland in particular. I mean, you think of the other professions in Gaelic Ireland, like lawyers and doctors. It's within the family. The family is the is the sort of closed order where you hand down traditions, like Erenachs and so on. It's a very family kind of focused type of society, and it's an almost a natural thing to happen in that kind of society.
Even amongst historians,
I'm sure.
But I mean, it's still happening today. I mean, Latin America and in Africa,
priests
are, most of the time living with somebody who is just totally normal. So it's just gone on.
Now, is there anyone else that's going to come in? Yeah, two questions here, because we're going to have to wrap up shortly. I'll take you first, yeah.
I just want to go back to something you were talking about earlier on. I wonder, what order rulers and leaders went Protestant for the sake of finding a fertile wife?
Could you repeat that there?
You mentioned earlier on that it was not just Henry VIII, that there was lots of other rulers that went Protestant to get rid of the wife to find one that they could have a child with.
I wasn't implying that. I was suggesting that in the various other tweaks, there are people who do get, I'm trying to think if there's anyone quite like Henry in the sort of
not like
the
Henry.
Speed through which there may have been instances where there were people who it was easier, for instance, often to get divorces, and there's an emerging theology of divorce even, because once marriage stops being a sacrament, you can be more flexible in those matters. But there are also cases where, for instance, the Danish monarchy, for example, there are definitely, there's one of the Christians becomes Lutheran in order to directly oppose a Catholic pretender, their rivals. So sometimes people do make religious decisions based on, as you say, considerations of power, but it doesn't always involve marriage and
religion. And 16th century French history is full of these examples. Yeah. The Valois dynasty is the dynasty of kings that are the monarchy in place through the religious wars from the 1560s onwards. And there, John mentioned earlier about the problem of having sickly kings or kings that are too young or indeed only girls that are there. And the French are a classic example of that. They teeter, they head towards civil war around 1559, 1560, partly because the mature king dies and he just leaves a couple of sickly sons and their mother, and it creates a kind of power vacuum. And then at the end of the century, the Protestant military leader converts to Catholicism in order to take the throne and the French throne. And he is the first Bourbon king. And his decision is entirely for politics. He's supposed to have said, the Paris was worth a mass. He never said that. But what he did say is that he justified it by saying, well, all of these things, they're really just about discipline. In doctrine, we're kind of the same. So he had a very kind of modern take on things, really, that, I'm not going to lose my soul because of this, because, ultimately, aren't we all Christians? And that's really one of the things on which he founded his reign.
Take the mic there if you want to. Yeah.
Hi, thanks. It's been mentioned, I think, a couple of times already, this idea that in the aftermath of the Reformation, there comes an internal movement within the Catholic Church at the Counter-Reformation or the Catholic Reformation. I suppose, looking at a chain of consequences, to what extent is the modern Catholic Church the incidental creation of Luther's actions? How could things have gone differently, and to what extent is the modern Catholic Church a reactive institution,
Yeah, that's a good point. We quite get to that on my list of questions here. John, to what extent is the Catholic Church since a creature of the Reformation?
I would say right up to the Second Vatican Council, very much is a creature of the Reformation.
Yeah.
And then you might say that what's happened in the Catholic Church after the Vatican Council is a secondary effect, where the Catholic Church finally gets around to doing some of the things like liturgy in the vernacular that the Reformers had proposed in the original. So I would say, you could argue that there is an argument, a historical argument to be made, that Catholicism is modern Catholicism is doubly the child of the Reformation process. That would be my...
I would think so. I think that's very true. I mean, when you read, documents like Lumen Gentium, for example, you just find lots and lots of Luther's idea right there. It's the same as when you read Meister Eckhart, 200 years before Luther, you find lots of ideas that come in Luther in Meister Eckhart. So, it's at the end of the day, it is an organic development in a way.
Okay, I'm going to have to wrap up here, guys. That's an interesting point to finish on. We sort of finished in the same place in some respects. I'd just like to thank our panel, Geza Thiessen, John McCafferty beside me here, and Alison Forrestal and, of course, Adrian Empey. I'd like to thank you, the audience, in particular those people who contributed to the discussion. Next, History Ireland Head School is kind of a half a head school. It's just got two panellists, part of the Dublin Literary Festival, Sunday the 4th of November, 2:30 in the RDS. We'll be looking at Eamon de Valera and Michael Collins with Joe Connell and with David McCullough. They'll both be discussing their books, so you're very welcome to come along to that. So I just have to thank you all for your attendance here and your attention. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Thank you.